Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm John Purcell. I'm sitting here with Sarah McDooling, and we're across from Osher Goodsberg, and he's coming to talk about his memoir, Back After the Break. Welcome, Osher.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm thrilled to be here at the Booktopia HQ, surrounded by lots and lots of books. I'm sitting in a back room here at the incredible Booktopia HQ, operation system, and it's thrilling. You've got an Ian Foster book right here, which is really, really good. And I hope you've got The Machine Stops in here, because yes, indeed, The Machine Stops, yeah. Which is one of the most brilliant science fiction. I love a bit of science fiction, and if you want to get truly terrified, read that, and then realize that he wrote it in a time when steam was the hottest thing on the scene.
I love that we've kicked off with Ian Foster.
Both of us love Ian Foster.
It's terrifying, though. Isn't it terrifying the way he predicts the iPad? He predicts it completely. He predicts the internet. Like, everything, he completely predicted. And there's, like, really archaic BBC production of it. If you go back in the earliest days of chroma key and tube cameras and stuff, they made an in-studio version of it, trying to figure it out. It's not very good. It's kind of like, but they try, and I'm kind of surprised that it hasn't yet been developed. But enough about Ian Foster and my science fiction obsession. Let's talk about my book. Who has the balls to write a memoir at 44? It's more of a half-time report, really, isn't it? It's hardly a...
It's a game of two halves.
Yeah, it's a game of two halves. Look, if I make it to 88, I'll be thrilled. And that'll be more than enough for me, that's for sure. But yeah, I'm so grateful that I had the chance to publish this. Did you know it started as a storytelling show. There's a theatre in Sydney called Giant Dwarf, and they run a thing on Monday nights once, first Monday of the month, called Story Club. And I was invited to come and tell some stories. They're part of the Chaser development pipeline, the Story Club team. They're wonderful, wonderful people. Zoe Norton Lodge and Ben Jenkins. And so I've told a few stories for them. And then I was invited to be a part of a fundraiser for them about, what was it? It was like, What Can't You Live Without, I think. And it was at Sydney Town Hall. And I've been through some pretty dark times. And I thought, you know what? What else am I going to be able to have a conversation and talk about what actually went on in my life between 2014 to kind of mid 2016? Except, I don't want it to be a newspaper article. I don't want it to be a website. I don't want it to be an Instagram post. I'll tell it as a story. So I told it as a 15-minute story about the day I lost my mind. You can find that. It's on an ABC podcast I did, and it's on the Story Club podcast. And through that story, I started, people had heard that story and I started becoming, I basically told a story about how I had experienced psychosis and I had, paranoid delusions and, was living with really frightening anxiety and paranoia and seeing things. And it was really awful. And then the drugs that I was on for that and kind of how I managed to find my way back to health from that. And it was because of that story that an opportunity opened up to come and work with Sane Australia, and I now sit on the board of directors at Sane Australia, which is, it was through that story. There's a few other things, but it kind of showed that, yes, I'm okay to talk about it and, have an advocacy around mental illness. And I was telling the more private, more detailed version of that story to, kind of small groups of benefactors for Sane Australia, and basically telling the version that I didn't really tell publicly at first, but like kind of the more grisly version. And my CEO Jack Heath says, you really should write a book because that story is going to help a lot of people. And I remembered when I was getting sober, I remembered sitting in how do I put this? I'm a member of a fellowship of men and women who work to achieve sobriety together. And I remember sitting in one of those meetings. And someone put their hand up and shared their story really authentically and all the grisly bits. And I remember sitting, I was really struggling. I was having a very hard time. And I heard this person share their story and I was like, hang on a second. Everything that they just said, that's me right now. But they seem to be doing okay. They're holding down a job. They've got a wife, they've got kids. How did they do that? Okay. The best ideas that I have landed me kind of unemployed and on the other side of the world and paying rent out of my savings. This person over there might have better ideas than I have. I might have to think that my ideas aren't the best ideas always and start listening to them. And it was only through hearing another person's story that I saw that, there's another way. It doesn't have to be this way. And so that's the reason why I wanted to tell this story, was to be as authentic as possible. I'm terrified. I'm terrified to be as authentic. I'm really scared. Yeah. I'm really scared that, because there's some parts that if you just printed it out of context, it would come across quite salaciously. But, you know, what happened to me doesn't turn up from a vacuum. You know, it's an entire life that led to these points in my life where things broke down. And it's important to tell all those stories that, you know, if, you know, you've gone through these traumatic experiences, if you've not looked after it, it can balloon and develop through coping strategies to try and manage it. It can balloon and develop into something far more serious if you don't get it taken care of. And so I really wanted to just kind of share my story as authentically as possible in the hope that it would encourage people to go, oh, I've seen that guy. He looks familiar. Oh, that story, that kind of parts of that, this part doesn't resonate with me, but that part resonates with me. Oh, he seems to have figured out, you know, the only thing I figured out was to go see a damn doctor and then see another and another and another and then do what they bloody said, take the drugs, do the work, you know. And that's the reason why I'm doing it, because I just really want people to feel that they're not alone, and that, I mean, complex mental illness affects 1 in 4 Australians. There's a lot of people that it's affected by. I mean, even just here, you know, even just today, because I've started being quite public about it. Just today, someone disclosed to me that their father took his own life, right? And it's everywhere. 8 people a day in Australia will take their own lives, right? If that was the road toll, we'd stop traffic tomorrow. And everyone's taking buses until we figure out how to learn how to drive. We can't lose this many people. This is terrible. But it's not. So we don't talk about it, but we should talk about it. And even that's a very extreme and painful and, you know, kind of horrible end to this kind of pain. But it doesn't mean that people aren't gritting their teeth trying to, you know, muscle through a life of agony. And it doesn't need to be that way. It doesn't need to be that way.
And so, if you're talking 1 in 4, that means that there's families and friends and everyone else who's around. Well,
precisely.
Everyone would have it at some yeah, kind of contact.
Exactly. You know, if one person in the family, a son, a daughter, a father, a wife, a brother, a sister has it, everyone in the family is affected by what's going on. It's not just that one person and everyone else is happy families. No, you're dealing with someone who's dealing with, you know, some pretty serious stuff. And it's important as a society, as a community, I think, that we start recognizing and start talking about the things that, you know, are worrious and that there is help. And the life doesn't have to be full of anxiety. It doesn't have to be full of pain. It doesn't have to be full of, you know, depression. And there is an enormous amount of help, and there's a huge amount of things you can do to help yourself and have some control back in your life. And I would really hope that through putting this book out there, and yes, there's some sensational stuff in there and it might be taken out of context, and that's, you know, that's just fine. But I would hope that in putting this out there, because of the role that I've played in the greater popular cultural sphere of the last 20 years or so, there's enough familiarity there that people can go, oh yeah, I recognize that. Oh, let me have a read of that. Oh, yeah, that sounds familiar. Oh, maybe I don't have to deal with this every day. Maybe I can get a bit of freedom from this oppressive thing that's trapped inside my head that's stopping me from having a life where I can enjoy a nice day. Well, that's a long answer to your first question. Sorry.
when we look around, and if you're thinking 1 in 4, there are a lot of people walking past you every day who are putting a smile on and just getting through the day. You're putting a smile on in front of, you know, millions of people, you know, on TV. And so you coming out and actually saying, the smile wasn't always real.
No, I'm not saying that. The smile was always real.
Was?
The smile was always real, because the moments when I was on camera, those are the moments where I was in a flow state and everything was quiet. All right. That was and I talk about that in the book, because I was a little kid when I've been having like ruminating anxiety for as long as I could remember. And I think I wrote about it in the book. I think there was 2 really serious episodes, one when I was 3, one when I was 5. And it's been like that my whole life. And the only thing that stopped the fear and then the fear of the fear and then the fear of 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 the fear, the only thing that stopped that was being on stage. I don't know why, but it was. So when I was on stage, it comes from being in control. Because when you're on stage, you know what you're going to say next. You know this person's going to walk here, that person's going to go there, and then everyone else is quiet and you're talking. There's a lot of ego involved as well. it was, that was, oh, everything's fine. Everything's okay. How do I do this all the time? And so I just pursued a life where I did that, you know, whether it be in music, and I played in bands for a long time, played in orchestras, played in all kinds of things. And then through radio, you know, it was just those, yeah, those 10, 15, 25, 30 seconds of talking in between songs on the radio. Oh, everything's okay. You know, just those tiny little, that respite from that constant swirling eagle above my head, ready to dive at me at any moment, to fill my body with physical pain. Because when anxiety's on, it's actually, it's physically painful. That's, people don't realize that. I've felt in my life, I've felt actual hands gripping around my throat, even though there's nobody there. Like, but the tactile sensation is on your skin. It's really weird when that happens. I can promise you, but that's your brain really playing tricks on you.
So many people are worried that they'll die. Like, yeah. They think they have a heart attack. Sorry.
Yeah.
I'm getting emotional listening to you.
Right. But it's only in being on stage, and it's only being on camera. And so to answer your question, yeah, like, at those times when I was on camera, I was like, oh, finally, this is, everything's fine, everything's okay. Yes, I'm breaking someone's heart and telling her she didn't receive a rose, but
but I'm in control.
But everything's all right, because we're all here together and everyone's working together, and this is going to be all right right now. Everything's going to be great. Cool. All right. And then I step back outside, and then the storm starts again.
So that's some extremes there.
Yeah.
And living with that kind of extreme calm and fine, and then totally out of control. Like, how do you manage that?
Well, at the time that I write about, I was on a fairly decent amount of medication. Yeah. That's for sure. I was on two different kinds of antipsychotics and a serotonin reuptake inhibitor and something else. Those four drugs I was on at the peak of it. I had to try a lot of different medication combinations for it to work. It's not just like a Panadol, you know. Just, yeah, you know, if the three of us have a headache, the three of us can take a Panadol, the three of us will have a fairly common response to that drug entering our system. But if the three of us are exhibiting some sort of psychological issue, we can't all take the same drug. You know, it's got to be whatever it is that has led to you, you know, my lifestyle, my body shape, my everything, you know, it's all very, very different. So yeah, I coped initially with, you know, being on meds. And so I like to work with two doctors. I have a psychologist and a psychiatrist. So I would say, like, if you equate it to rally driving, the psychiatrist is the mechanic that makes sure the engine works fine, and the psychologist is the navigator that, you know, turn left, turn right. All right. So that's kind of how it's worked for me, and it's worked really well.
And is that, like, how many times did you have to get to the right people? Because I've known people who have, friends and family who have gone, and got the wrong advice and gone on the wrong path, then dropped out.
But
and
it sort of never ends.
Yeah, like, I got really frustrated. Yeah, there was, when I wasn't getting better, I just, you know, I gave them a couple of months. Mm. I gave it a couple of months, and then I had to make a decision. It's like, look, I'm not getting better. Mm. And I'm going to try another option. I'm going to try another, you know, treatment pathway, and we'll see what else happens. And whether it be, you know, then my biases were shifted when I moved to another doctor, and then what they might have been telling me the same thing, and then it stuck. I don't know. That might have been the case. Most probably it could have been the case. But, yeah, you're not married to them. You can change your psychologist. You don't have to, if you're not clicking, it's fine. You can go to someone that you click with, and you should find someone that you click with and you trust with, and you should have outcomes and goals that you're searching towards. You can't just, like, go forever. You know, we're very, very lucky in Australia that we have a mental health plan that a GP can prescribe you 10 sessions, which is just, you can achieve a lot in 10 sessions with a good psychologist. You really can. And that's extraordinary that we have that healthcare system in our country, because when I went, when the psychosis first showed up, I was living in America and in Venice Beach, actually. And anyone who's been to Southern California, particularly in Venice, will know there's a large homeless population there. And a large portion of that homeless population is battling some very complicated, unmedicated mental illness situations. And it's full on. But just, they don't have the healthcare that we do.
Yeah.
We're so lucky here. We are just so lucky. So, but now though, I cope in a very different way. Over the course, I was very, very lucky in that once we shifted, and I talk all about this in the book. Once we shifted my hypothesis of what was actually going on, and we ended up with an OCD diagnosis, we shifted to OCD medication. And it was on that OCD medication that I started to get a lot better pretty quickly. And what happened is that my brain started to heal enough in that the new neural pathways were able to form, and that I could challenge the paranoia successfully. Because before, when the paranoid delusions would come, I'd do everything I could to try and challenge it, but it wouldn't stick. It wouldn't happen. You know, I was at war with my own perception of reality, which is really bad, and I don't recommend it at all.
It doesn't sound great.
No, it's not. It's really, really awful. It would be like saying to you, Sarah, it would be like saying, I can't believe you're wearing that in the pool right now. And you'd be like, we're not in a swimming pool. Oh, what do you mean? How come you're not wet? We are all of us up to our necks in water right now. What are you talking about? How come you're not wet?
That's terrible.
You know, it was like, that's an extreme example, but it was as if like, and then in my head, I'm like, oh, I can see it. She can't see it. That means I'm okay. And then grappling with this idea that I'm struggling and my brain's misfiring. And then that's where
the pain is.
Yeah. That's where the pain is. And so as I got better and better and better, which I was very grateful for. The side effects, every medication has side effects. So as the side effects of the medication started to become more of the issue, all right, the initial reasons I went on the meds started to become less and less of an issue, and the side effects, and one of the side effects, both weight gain and libido, and anyone who's been on these kind of meds will tell you that that's exactly what happens. And so over the course of about 9 months with my psychiatrist, we went down bit by bit by bit by bit by bit by bit by bit all the way till we got to the very minimum therapeutic dose. And then we made a decision together. It's like, okay, we're going to give it a shot. We're going to try life without it. And it's going to be rocky, but we'll see how we go. And so now it was initially quite a rough adjustment period. It was like going from that really nice, kind of clean, beautiful, you know, freshly laid tarmac on the interstate that they've just put in on the way in a Canberra or something, and then straight onto a dirt road, you know, but still at 100, you know, like, oh, shit, and just kind of holding on. Thankfully, through, you know, the incredible understanding of my wife and stepdaughter and my friends and family, we managed to kind of get through it. And now I have there's a big difference between not taking meds and not needing to take meds, all right? Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of things I do every day to make sure I don't need to take them again. There's high possibility that in the course of my lifetime, I will be on meds again. Right now, I'm not. And that, you know, that is, you know, I make sure that I eat right, as right as I can. I make sure I work out every day. In some way, shape or form, I make sure I try and prioritize sleep as much as possible. I journal every day. I keep in touch with my doctors. I check in with my wife all the time. And I try very much to meditate every day. And I try to have, you know, be sure that everything I do has a purpose. And, it does take a bit of extra heavy lifting, but these are the things that I need to do to maintain control of, because when it first started, the paranoid delusions were, it was as if, you know, you're driving down the big main road here, right? And there's a billboard, all right? And your face is a foot from the billboard. So all you can see is this. And that billboard just is screaming horror at you. And that's all you can see, all right? So you're trying to connect with your family, but your field of vision is so completely, completely taken up by this massive billboard, all right? That billboard is now about the size of a post-it note. Mm-hmm. But it is still in my field of vision, all right? Every day I still have this. Every day the thing that initially sent me over the edge is still with me every day. And I go, okay, there it is. All right, I see you in the corner. I get you.
Some days, great analogies.
Yeah, help. But you know, some days it gets bigger. If I've been losing out on my sleep, if I haven't been working out, if I'm stressed out, it gets bigger and can sometimes overtake things again. And then you can't see around it. You can't see your family. You can't see your friends. You can't enjoy food. You know. Mm-hmm. And then as you notice that it gets smaller and smaller, but it is always still there. And I've spoken to my psychiatrist about it. And he goes, yeah, it's probably going to be there for the rest of your life. And that's okay at that point. I mean, I think on screen it's been shown really well. Remember at the end of the Russell Nash film, Beautiful Mind, the Russell Crowe, John Nash film, yeah. A Beautiful Mind. At the very end of that film, I'm not going to spoil it for you, but at the end of that film, he's doing some work in a library and he looks over and he sees those people and just kind of acknowledges them.
Yeah.
And it's like that. It's like they'll kind of always be there. It'll always be there, and just being an acceptance of that is a really big part of it as well.
It's something that you manage, not something that you get rid of.
I just understand, and being an acceptance that that's the case, being acceptance that this is what I've got, this is my brain, this is what I have, these switches are going to stay on forever. There's no turning it off. I can either fight it and be in a lot of pain trying to fight it, or I can just go, okay, there it is.
Adapt and
there it is. There it is. Okay. What can I do to make it a little bit smaller? Okay, let's do that.
Yeah. You could write a book.
Luckily, I have.
how much of because when you describe the meditation, the healthy eating, the being more in now. How much is that? Because I got stuck with the male brain, and the male brain especially took a long time to mature and to start being a little bit more conservative thinking and a bit moderate, you know. How much is it was tied in with that? Did you almost have to get the kind of steadiness that is required to do? I mean, we all saw the photo that was going around the old internets the other day with you on the front of Men's Health.
Oh yeah,
yes. Yeah, good job.
Thank you.
So how much of that is kind of this? Because I've got family who are sort of getting into the 40s.
Yeah.
And they're starting to get that control over some of these things. Yeah. And I certainly feel it with my own mind, just that I've got more of a control over it.
Well, that's all part of getting older, I think. Mm. Yeah, absolutely. I was really lucky that a lot of the skills I was able to draw on to help me get better were skills that I'd learned in getting sober. So that was a big part of it. I started to get sober at 36.
Yeah.
So, and that was where I was really, really lucky in that it was in sobriety that I first learned to question my automatic thoughts. And like, okay, so I'm really angry that, you know, as far as I'm concerned, that person's being really mean, but are they? Is it just the way I'm hearing it?
Mm.
Oh, it is. They're just being them. They're just doing their job. It's me.
That's a lot of
self-awareness. But in sobriety, you have to learn that sort of stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Because you have to learn the reasons why you're drinking.
Do you feel the will gets stronger by using
it? Oh, yeah, but it's like any muscle. Yeah. You know, it's like any muscle. So I was really, really lucky that on the day that my brain just popped right open, I was lucky enough to know that something was wrong. That's what I was absolutely blessed with, all right, because I remember my mentor at the time said the problem with crazy people is they don't know they're crazy because your reality's switched.
Yeah.
And so as far as you're concerned, you're like, oh, no, you're in on it. If you don't understand what I'm talking about, you're part of it. They've got to you first. Shit, I can't even trust you now. Because as far as your brain's concerned, that's what's real.
Yeah.
And you had the knowledge that something was
not. I was very lucky in that. It was actually, I describe it all in the book. I was in Amsterdam. I was at a business school and I was trying to meditate. And through meditation, I was able to kind of just separate, just lean back just enough to observe my thoughts. And it was there that I could see, oh, wow, everything is through a filter of doom and cataclysm. Oh, wow. Okay. That's not good. And it was because of that that I was able to, you know, really call out for help because it's like, something's wrong. Something's really wrong with me. I need to figure this out. But like I said, this stuff didn't just appear out of nowhere. It's, you know, there's some experiences that happened in my life that led to it. So that, you know, the first, I don't know, first half of the book is, you know, talking about early experiences with, anxiety and social phobia and things like that. And then as I got old enough, you know, and it started to get, like many things, this illness that I've got, it's certainly progressive and it just got worse and worse. But you know, somewhere around my mid-teens, a very handy depressant showed up in a liquid form that it was socially acceptable and everyone was just A-okay if you had a few of them. So, you know, that's where drinking showed up. And I think for a lot of people, self-medication is a big part of it. You know, if you need a couple of beers to get, you know, down after a big day, you know, that might be one thing. But if you can't connect with other humans or if you're using beer or anything else as an avoidant behavior, you know, you may want to look out because these things are progressive. You know, it's not sustainable. It's not sustainable. And then I talk about all that in the book. You know, there was that and a few other avoidant behaviors, which you'll get to read about. You might not look at your friendly neighborhood rose counter ever again quite the same once you find out what was actually happening around, you know, 2005, 2006. But it was a bit of darkness back there.
Does that worry you? Or?
It doesn't really, because I know I'm not alone, all right? I know I'm not the only person who have done that. Mm. And, you know, like I said, if I can say, look, you know, if someone reads it and go, oh, hang on a sec, I do that, and it's getting more intense every time just to get the same amount of relief or hit off of it, oh, this is a progressive thing and it might end up in trouble. I mean,
mission accomplished.
Yeah, well, let's hope. That's the idea. I mean, it was the quote that stuck with me the first day I never drank. when I woke up after a night, and it was Lao Tzu's quote, "Be careful of the direction which you're heading, you may just end up there." And I could see clear as day. I was like, I know exactly where this is going. I can see it clear as day. There's no way that if I'm on rails right now, heading directly to rocks, and if I don't, you know, if I don't change, I'm like on a ship, you know, just like heading straight to the rocks. If I don't turn the wheel, that's exactly where I'm going to end up. So I was very lucky that I had that opportunity to turn the wheel a bit. Yeah.
Well, this book seems packed full of.
Yeah, there's a lot in there.
Yeah.
There's a lot in there.
Is it, you made a joke before about, you know, writing your memoir when you're still so young.
Yeah.
I have a theory that the younger you start, the more memoirs you write. Do you think that you got another couple in you?
Well, considering, like, certainly since the magazine came out, the Men's Health magazine, and certainly since I've been talking quite publicly about my management strategies, I certainly think there's a thirst for knowledge around management strategies, around, you know, just generally, you know, whether you've got episodic anxiety or episodic depression or just generally life, you know, there's definitely a thirst for knowledge around that, and about just the discipline of, you know, you don't just, if you just turn up every day and run through the same program, what are you going to end up with?
Yeah.
All right. But if you just lean forward, just 1 or 2 degrees forward from center in a direction that you wish to head, you'd be surprised where in 20 years that can end you up. And like that can end up in a positive or a negative, right? So I don't know, maybe that's the next one.
I like the sound of that.
Yeah.
Osha, thank you so much for coming and talking to us.
I'm great. I'm sorry, amazing. I rabbited on so much.
Oh, it was fantastic.
You can listen to more.
Oh, really? What happens now? Like, do you read a bit of it? I don't know. What do you?
Oh, do you want to?
I don't know. Do you?
I haven't done that.
Yeah, I would love if you read it.
Let me put my specs on. When are you going to put this out?
On the 20th, I think.
Yeah. On the 20th? Mm-hmm. So I'm a photographer, right? And as a photographer, there's a few things that I've done as a shooter, and one of those things was to document my life. I took a self-portrait every day for a year. This is in 2009, before there were front-facing cameras on phones, all right? So in 2009, I took a DSLR, 2 camera flashes, light stands, that's triggers, commitment. Everything all around the world with me. I think it was 13 countries by the time I finished it. And I shot a self-portrait every day for a year as a challenge, as a photography challenge. I ended up shooting the first season of Idol by myself, which turned out to be the last season of Australian Idol, Idol ending, my radio career in America beginning, me getting a green card, all kinds of things. But I also shot the last 6 months of my drinking and the first 6 months of my sobriety.
Whoa.
So it's all documented.
That's amazing.
It's self-portraits. Yeah, it's all documented. But because of that, I knew how important it was to, you know, document really, really important moments in your life. And there's a photograph in here. It's a bit intense. I was in London. It was, I write about this in the book, and I was barely clinging on to reality, barely clinging on to reality. And all I was experiencing very, very, very heavy, active suicidal ideation. It was horrible. And I thought, I need to take a photo of what my face looks like. All right.
I'm scared to see.
Yeah. So that's a photograph of me in London. And you can see it in my eyes, can't you?
Yeah, that's scary.
You can see it in my eyes. It's like, and I'm seeing things at that point.
That doesn't even seem like the same person.
Yeah, I know, right? But I'm actually seeing things.
Oh.
I was seeing stuff, and it was like visions. It was really, really horrible. And I was so, so, so afraid. Let's read a bit. What's a part that you'll know?
We need some like music.
You need something musicy? let's go.
Like the thinking music on a game.
Yeah, you need the thinking music. Okay, so what I'll read you is like, because people often ask, how do you start? In 1995, I'd been in radio for a year, and I'd just been accepted into university. All right, I'd gone and done it. If you ever fail in high school, people don't tell you this. They put the fear of God in you if you fuck up high school. They're like, your career's over. It's not. Just go and do a TAFE course. It's something you're really good at. And you get heaps of marks. And then, boom, you're in. This is what I did. I went and did a course in music. Kabam. Business. QUT. But I just got a job in radio. And so this is what my day looked like. My band was called Feebles Junkie, by the way. You'll read about this. So it was 1995 and Feebles were running hot. We were playing most weekends and building a solid following. While the band was gaining momentum and we were writing and rehearsing new material, I was picking up more and more overnight shifts on the radio station midweek. With my new university schedule 2 to 3 times a week, my day went something like this. 9:30 a.m, wake up and head into QUT. 11 a.m, lecture on writing skills. 12 p.m, go and grab something to eat and fall asleep on the kidney lawn. 1 p.m, sit in the tutorial wondering what the hell I was doing there and why everyone else in the room seemed to know what was going on. 2 p.m, head into the radio station and prep for the night's shift. 4 p.m, head downstairs to the studio to panel Martin Malloy. 6 p.m, go further downstairs, pack the truck for the night shows, thunder drops and head out. 9 p.m, finish work, head to the rehearsal room. 9:30, rehearse with the band. 11:30, head back to the station with my sleeping bag and crash on the audio booth floor. 1:30 a.m, the late night jock and radio legend John Peters wakes me up and I start pulling my CDs to play for my shift. 2 a.m, start my shift bringing the better music variety from the 70s, 80s and 90s to the late night inhabitants of Brisbane. 5 a.m, while still on air, pull the CDs for the breakfast shift. 6 a.m, get off air, spend 10 minutes pulling all my CDs away and head home. 6:45 a.m, crash in bed and set the alarm to do it all again.
Whoa. How long was that sustainable?
That lasted about 6 weeks. But, you know, I guess what's interesting is, like, that seems intense, but I was just replying to Instagram. Someone wrote on Instagram just then, you know, it's all well and good that you've got time to work out for this men's health thing. I work 9 to 5. I haven't got time for that. When I did this men's health thing, which involved at least an hour of training every single day, sometimes I'd finish work at 4 a.m., go home, sleep for a couple of hours, be at the gym by 10, go from the gym and get something else done, and then be back on set and do it all again to 4 o'clock in the morning, because that's what it takes to do my work at my level. I mean, and that's what it's always taken. And I don't want people to be on any illusions that, you know, once you get a job at this level of television, that it's easy. You just turn up, you say some stuff on camera, you go home. No. It's been 12 and 18 hour days since I was 20. And it will probably be for the, as far as I know, that is what our career is.
I don't think many people have that illusion. I hope they don't have that illusion.
I think a lot of people do. Really? They think, yeah, people think, I live in an apartment, man. I drive a secondhand car. I don't live some freaking flash life, mate. I just, you know, this is what you work a lot to, but that's what it's always taken. And to then be able to be given the incredible honor and the privilege of being able to work with such a great team to put a book like this out. I'm just so grateful. I'm really lucky. And I'm grateful that you guys had me on your show. Thank you.
Well, we're grateful that you came in. We're grateful that you wrote the book.
Yeah.
Fun.
I think it's going to be really amazing.
Let's hope.
Wait for Australia to get their hands on it.
Oh, let's hope. I'm sure.
You're a bit nervous.
I'm so scared.
Thank you very much.
No worries. Thank you.
And you can get hold of back after the break. It sounds like I'm saying back after break. We're not going to be back after break.
Do you know why is the title funny?
Because it's back after the break.
But what kind of break?
Oh.
Oh, wow. I didn't even think of that. My mind is blown.
I made a psychosis pun.
Wow, you did.
I made a psychosis joke in my title.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Talk about where you put the comma.
Wow.
Yeah. Back after the break.
That is phenomenal.
And we won't be back after the break, but you can get a copy at booktopia.com.au. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.